He went 31,000 miles by train and gave 352 speeches in which he gave Republicans hell as only Harry Truman could. Truman's 1948 whistle-stop tour is one of the most storied odysseys in American presidential history. Philip White has chronicled the story of that journey in a new book, Whistle Stop. Harry Truman was a vast underdog heading into that election. His Whistle Stop tour saved his presidency. Philip White is also the author of Our Supreme Task, How Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain Speech Defined the Cold War Alliance. He's a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post. He joins us this morning via Skype from his home in Denver. And Philip White, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me. Good morning to you.
Well, just how much trouble was Harry Truman in as the 1948 election year began, Philip? Because, you know, you read about his troubles and you just can't believe that any politician could rally from that kind of deficit and win an election for anything.
Indeed, yes. He was in a lot more trouble than most people realize. When he first found out that FDR had died, he had been vice president for just 82 days and had only met with FDR in person twice during that spell. And so when he ran into Eleanor Roosevelt at the White House, he offered his condolences and, you know, gave the familiar line of, let me know if there's anything I can do. And she said, well, actually, Mr. President, I think I should be saying that to you, for it's you that's in trouble now.
Yes. One of the most famous quotes in American presidential history. I love that quote.
Yeah, it's terrific. And so really what was going on with Truman, I mean, initially, obviously, he had the horrendous decision of whether to drop the atomic bombs on Japan to end the war in the Pacific, and took that decision as he believed that, as his generals told him at the time, it might save up to 500,000 American troops in the long run. And obviously that's open to debate whether their estimates were accurate or not. And then, you know, attended wartime conferences with Churchill and Stalin, having never been in this kind of international diplomatic environment. And then after the war, there were some major strikes that crippled the country, millions of work days lost, as workers really were saying, well, hang on, you know, we've been away at war, number one, and secondly, we haven't had any wage increases for years because of the war. It's time for comeuppance for the industrial leaders. And those industrial leaders were saying, well, wait a second, we're just trying to get back on our feet after the war too. And so millions and millions of strike days lost, and Truman busted those strikes, and in the process really alienated the big labor base that had obviously helped FDR be in power since the early 30s. And so not only did the labor movement support that had really put FDR in power and helped keep him there, was that eroded, but there was also the double split in the party. And so you had Henry Wallace marching his Gideon's army, as he put it, leftward. And then you also had the Dixiecrats raising Cain about Truman's very ambitious civil rights program.
So that was headed by Strom Thurmond, right?
That's correct, yeah. And he said, you know, that some of the quotes from Strom Thurmond are quite outrageous, including one where he said there weren't enough troops in the U.S. Army to end segregation in the South. And so you really had that solid South for the Democrats, another really important voting bloc gone for Truman. And then you also had abroad the Berlin blockade, where obviously there were the Western occupation zones, and the Russians were preventing any road, rail, or river traffic into those. And that was threatening to starve a lot of people that were relying on the Allies.
And so his chances heading into 1948 then, and the election that year, were considered to be what then, Philip?
Were considered to be really bad. In a poll of newspaper and magazine editors and reporters, 69% of them backed Dewey to win that election. And obviously that culminates in the erroneous Chicago Tribune headline of Dewey defeats Truman, because they were so confident of that result that they printed the result before it was a result.
So Harry Truman's in trouble then heading into that election. Whose idea was it then to do something as extensive and really maybe unprecedented as this 31,000-mile tour and 350 speeches to go along with it?
Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Rowe who had been a kind of unofficial advisor to FDR, and he was not too well liked, him and some of his associates, by by Truman. And so when Clark Clifford, another Missouri connection, Clark Clifford had practiced law in St. Louis, and when he got hold of this memo really outlining the big issues and the challenges of the 1948 election, this was in late 47, he kind of took credit for this, knowing that the president wouldn't accept it if the real author had been revealed. And in this, one of the things that was revealed was the extent of Truman's problems. And Roe had recommended, and Clifford and a lot of Truman's other advisors agreed, that really the only way for Truman to win was for them to stop trying to force him into FDR's mold of this eloquent, very well-spoken politician, and let Truman be Truman, which was, obviously he was a very plain-spoken man and he was great in conversations, but was very uncomfortable reading from these long prepared texts, which they were used to giving to FDR. And so once they had done a couple of trial runs, really they felt like, okay, we're right on this. We'll give him a few bullet points and let Harry be Harry and we'll send him out.
We're talking about Harry Truman's famous whistle stop tour of 1948. Where did the tour take him exactly, Philip?
Well, it were really two parts. There was a June portion, which he called a non-political inspection tour, which was very much political. And this went through the Midwest and then went out to the West Coast. So it was primarily the West Coast. He went out to the Pacific Northwest, where there had been very bad flooding that year, and because of the efforts of these seven young men in the research division, which was the first time the Democrats had had such an organization, he had very specific information about the flood and the impact, and really every audience that he addressed, he had a few little nuggets of info. And so when he went back out on the train platform, if it was talking about the flood, well, he could maybe say how many homes had been affected, or compare it historically to other floods. And then if he went to a farm town, he could speak intelligently about the state of farming and prices of, beef and corn and everything else, and really just a level of detail that was unprecedented. And so there was this tour out west, and the name Whistle Stop actually came from one of his great opponents, Robert Taft, who, even though he didn't go on to win the nomination that year, he said, complained to the press, well, Truman's just out west blackguarding Congress at every whistle stop. And rather than rejecting that, there was a lot of uproar from some of these small towns that Truman stopped in. And Truman ended up, he liked the name. And so that's what they adopted as kind of the name of the tour.
How many people would turn out for these stops in some of these rural towns along the train tracks? Because this is sort of a very interesting part of this story.
Yeah, I mean, really, it was everything from him speaking in big stadiums. One of the excuses for using taxpayer money, I guess, to go out west for this inspection tour in June was he was giving the commencement address at University of California at Berkeley. And there were over 65,000 people there. And then you contrast this to him speaking at 11:30 p.m. one night on that trip in his pajamas to about between 12 and 15 people, depending on which account you believe. So, yeah, it was everything down from a handful of folks in, as Taft correctly said, a little whistle-stop town to big stadiums and everything in between.
I should point out Philip White will be speaking on Wednesday evening at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. That's the one downtown at 14 West 10th Street. To grab a seat, go to kclibrary.org. I mean, did Truman recognize that this was his only chance of winning the presidency outright on his own behalf here?
Yes, he did. And actually, he found out that the reporters had on Dewey's train had dubbed that particular train the Victory Special. And not least because Dewey and his wife were so confident that they were going to win that she had started planning how she was going to redecorate the White House. So, I mean, this is the level of, I wouldn't say hubris, but overconfidence that he was going up against. And so his aides immediately responded by calling his train the Last Chance Special. And so I think they everyone down to Bess Truman, the first lady, thought that Truman would not just lose, but just be destroyed. I mean, so much so that Elmo Roper, the pollster, stop polling in September, mm-hmm. if you can believe that, because mm-hmm. he said that Truman needs a miracle to pull off a comeback here. And that was just the situation he found himself in. But Truman never lost confidence. There is no report from any of his aides in any of the firsthand accounts that have been written of him ever getting glum and thinking that they're going to lose. And in fact, after Dewey and Earl Warren were put on what reporters called a Republican dream ticket, Truman just kind of laughed at that, listening to it in the White House. And Clark Clifford and others, you know, said, well, what do you think your chances are? And he snapped his fingers for emphasis and he said, I'm going to take Dewey like that. So, I mean, he was very, very combustible and very determined that there was no way that between Thurmond, Henry Wallace and Dewey that they were going to manage to pull the voter base apart and send him back to Independence, Missouri in defeat. He just wouldn't have it.
Philip White's new book is titled Whistle Stop, How 31,000 Miles of Train Travel, 352 Speeches, and a Little Midwest Gumption Saved the Presidency of Harry Truman. I mean, you think, you know, about all these miles and all these speeches, and you can't help but wonder how arduous a trip this journey was for the president, Philip.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, he was at age 64, was considerably older, I think 14 years older than Dewey. And Dewey made less than half the appearances and wrapped up his campaign a few days before the end, whereas Truman went on right to the very end. And as I mentioned, a pajama-clad president probably doesn't win you many rave reviews in the press. And a lot of his opponents in the press mocked him for coming out early in the morning and late at night, clad in very unpresidential pajamas. Now, I don't know whether they were, you know, Despicable Me or Transformers or something like that, you know, kids' pajamas or something a little more dignified. But it just shows you that Truman was just comfortable being himself. And yeah, he gave up to 16 speeches a day, and his throat got so raw at one point that his physician had to spray his throat in between every stop. But I think it took more of a toll on the press and some of his aides. Clark Clifford talked to him before they set out and said, you know, a little concern, Mr. President. And Truman said, oh, don't worry about me. I'll be fine. It's you I'm worried about killing. And Clifford, indeed, even as a young man, was so stressed out by the whole thing that he got a nasty case of boils all over him and claimed that he had nightmares for years afterwards about being struck on this, you know, horrendous bloody train. And some of the other staffers, you know, were really just flagging at the end. But one lady said to Truman at a certain stop along the way, Mr. Truman, you sound like you have a bad cold. And he said, oh, it's just because I'm riding around in the wind with my mouth open. so he was able to make light of this.
But you're exactly right. I mean, 20 hours straight some days, as many as 13, 14 speeches a day. It just is amazing to me. And not only that, I love some of the activities that Truman took part in as he took part in this whistle stop tour in September in Iowa of that year. It's 105 degrees outside, and he takes part in a plowing demonstration. You can't imagine a president doing that today. Now, of course, Harry was an old plower himself. How did he do in that plowing competition?
Well, I don't think he entered the officially sanctioned part of the competition, mm-hmm. but he did plow a demo furrow just to show that he could still plow straight, and made a quip about being a straight shooter, you know, in the White House, just as straight as the furrows that he could plow. But I think that was part of the appeal of Harry Truman to the voters once he got out and was able to get in front of millions of people, that when he spoke to soldiers on veterans affairs, they listened because he had been a soldier and had served in World War One. And as you mentioned, when he spoke to farmers, there was credibility there because he had worked the family farm. And even when he spoke to small business owners, he really had, again, some credibility there, yeah. because he had owned a haberdashery in Kansas City that had gone under in the financial problems of the early 20s. And so with each of these audiences, it wasn't just that he was folksy, but he was authentic in so many different roles into so many different audiences, because I think at heart he was a small town American who had the interest of small town Americans at heart. And so he was able to really speak from the heart. And I think that this that sense of authenticity is really what managed to carry him home, combined, of course, with that great work ethic that you mentioned.
Harry Truman's famous whistle-stop tour of 1948 is our topic today. Our phone number, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Mike from Lawrence. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call. I was taken to Independence, Missouri as a little kid, and as a 25-year Democrat now, it serves notice on today's Democrats to have as much gumption as Harry Truman did. And the other thing is, when he was dealing with the Dixiecrats and Executive Order 9938 that integrated the U.S. military, he was dealing with the ancestors of today's Tea Party. He was dealing with the Stennises and the Faubuses and the Thurmans and the George Wallaces that started the whole states' rights thing that comes to the Tea Party now. So I mean, he took a lot of gumption in his day, but he stood for the right thing. And it'd do some good for Democrats to realize that they need to stand behind the things they do, whether they're popular or not.
Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. What was the train like, Philip? How comfortable was it for a president of the United States and his family?
Well, I think for the president and his family, it was quite comfortable. You know, they had a nice sized bedroom there and bathroom next to it. And there was a formal dining room and kind of a living room area, which really was used as the staging room for each of his speeches. So, yeah, for them, it wasn't too bad, even though Bess Truman, for a large part of the trip, was back in Independence, Missouri, as she was probably one of the least willing first ladies in history, really. Just again, you know, that small town thing, and always hightailed it back when Truman was a senator. She just didn't really take to D.C. that well, so ended up spending most of her time back in Independence. And I think, though, for the reporters on the train, it was something of a different matter. You know, in the book, I mentioned the cramped quarters that they were in on the two train cars, and their numbers swelled over time as the tour went on, because Dewey was really just reading canned speeches over and over, even though as a former prosecutor, he was a very good speaker and had a very sonorous baritone. You know, it was nice to listen to, but he just kept repeating the same old buzzwords and catchphrases over and over, so much so that Truman accused the GOP of now standing for grand old platitudes. Huh. And so I think he and his advisors had a bit of a laugh about that. But so these reporters were really crammed in. You know, one I think said his head was on top of a folding toilet or something, some strange contraption, and they were, you'll see from a picture I have in there of the press corps, that they were jammed elbow to elbow, and certainly yes, wasn't much room. And I think just the rigors of being on the train day after day after day, and occasionally they would get off and, you know, stay in a governor's mansion, this type of thing, if it was offered. But those rooms for his advisors were certainly a lot smaller and a lot less comfortable. So, yeah, it was definitely fine for the president, and he was used to pretty simple accommodations anyway. But for those advisors and the press corps, they were jammed in really like cattle for, you know, several months.
The president was known for giving the Republicans hell, and in fact, it's been said that he gave them so much heck on that trip that Truman's advisors worried that he was going too far sometimes. What would he say that caused them to sort of wince and wonder if the president was going too far, Philip?
Well, I think there was only one speech later in the campaign, I believe it was in October, where he didn't say it outright, but he kind of implied, there was an implied connection between the German electorate and Hitler, you know, and he didn't come out and say it, but just saying that, you know, an uneducated electorate, you know, gave rise to this man, you know, as Churchill would have said, this bloody man, you know, as he referred to Hitler. Mm-hmm. But that was the kind of, oh, heck moment. And then there was another one that wasn't so much the level of fire that he took at the 80th Congress, but he was talking off the cuff and off the record with some reporters on that June leg of the trip. And was talking about Stalin and said, oh, you know, Uncle Joe is all right. It's just the rest, you know, he's kind of hostage to the Politburo and they're the real problem. So that got some unfortunate press, as you can imagine. But yeah, he really was running, though, as you say, more against the 80th Congress, which he called the Do Nothing Congress, than he was against Dewey. Mm-hmm. And he only mentioned Dewey's name twice in speeches, if you can believe that, in those 352 addresses, only two occurrences, Dewey's name. Whereas every single stop he was blasting Congress. And really what he was saying is, look, you know, I understand that no president has a mandate to just do whatever the heck they want. And, you know, even the party that has majority in both houses can't expect carte blanche. But, you know, this is just gridlock for gridlock's sake. You know, I've proposed these measures on civil rights, which he had proposed earlier than the two executive orders, one of which our caller kindly mentioned, one to desegregate the armed forces and another that guaranteed equal pay and hiring practices for federal employees, which were real milestones in civil rights. But outside of that, they won't give me anything on that. You know, I've even called Congress back into the Turnip Day Congress, as it was known, his special session in late summer of 48. And they still won't give me more low budget housing. We've got a housing crisis. I believe at one point almost a million people were without housing just in Chicago.
So was it fair for the president to label this Congress as do nothing when you look back at the record of that Congress?
I think that it was definitely an exaggeration. They had passed, you know, several fairly substantial measures. And this is an age, of course, where outside of wartime spending, once the peacetime conversion had gone on and demobilization, where a balanced budget was indeed possible. You know, we weren't talking about trillions of dollars in deficit. And so, you know, they delivered a pretty balanced budget and quite a few reforms had been passed. But Truman's point was, even in his exaggeration of this do-nothing label, that they hadn't gone far enough on housing, on federal funding for education, and on a lot of these issues where he felt that the role of government was to be interventionist, for good or for ill, and that this was what was needed in this post-war situation in America to take care of the little man, which he still saw himself as.
Let's go back to some phone calls here, Philip, and go to Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, you're on Up to Date. Again, our topic, this segment of our show, Harry Truman's whistle-stop tour of 1948. Good morning, Mike.
Hello. I've got two questions, and I'll ask them, and then anyways, did Harry go back and drink and talk to the reporters? And the second one was in the when Richard Nixon did a whistle stop thing, they all imitate Harry. Anyways, there was a guy named Richard Tuck, as I recall, and Nixon backed into a station to give a speech, and he had an engineer's outfit, and just as things were getting started, he gave the engineer and the to pull out of the station. So anyways, was there ever a similar, I mean, did anybody screw around with Harry, and did he go back and drink and talk to the reporters?
Sounds good, Mike. I appreciate it, though. What about that first question, Philip? Did Truman go back and talk to reporters and throw one back on occasion?
I'm not sure about the drinking that went on during the trip, to be honest with you. I know that back in March of 46, when he had gone to Fulton, Missouri with Winston Churchill to introduce Churchill for his Iron Curtain speech there, that, you know, there were a couple of bottles that were passed around and they were playing cards and having a good old time.
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, I know on the June inspection tour, it was a little more leisurely. He probably gave 6 or 8 speeches a day. And so, as I mentioned, he was talking, well, allegedly off the record, even though the comments made it into the press about Joe Stalin. And so one could imagine, you know, a couple of shots being poured, potentially, dare I say, but there's no real record of it. So I think on the tour itself, the main tour in September, that it was so hectic and he was often giving his first speech before 7 o'clock in the morning and often not getting done until midnight or later. And then local politicians would join the train at certain stops for a couple of stops just to talk policy until 2 or 3 a.m. And so I can imagine them having a little tipple there, but again, nothing's recorded. And I think that there was a lot less time than he probably thought he was going to have downtime, and also a lot less time than on that Doom tour. So I guess that's my long-winded way of saying I don't really know. Nothing came up in the research,
yeah.
But it wouldn't be outside the realms of possibility.
I'm not sure I got Mike's second question about Richard Nixon doing a similar tour, if any shenanigans ever went on with Harry's trip. I don't know if you got it any better than I did, Philip.
Oh, yeah. I'm not really sure. I know that a couple of times he did walk the train, and, you know, there was a couple of pictures of him driving the train and this kind of thing, or at least pretending to. And so he did like to converse with the staff, and certainly wasn't above it, you know, as politicians further down the line may have been a little more aloof. If Harry Truman liked to play the piano, you know, and he liked to read, well, he liked to talk even more. So he would, you know, he'd talk to anybody.
Yeah. Hey, just a final point before we got to go, Philip. This notion of the president spending so much time on the road, and more specifically on the train doing this whistle stop tour, how did that work with his responsibilities of running the country? How often were there conflicts between the politics and the responsibility he had of running the White House?
Well, they had, even for this day, obviously there was no internet or Skype, but they had a pretty sophisticated radio operation running both ways. There was a communication car on the train. And then so he was able to communicate back and forth with Washington. And as you mentioned, it was kind of a very tense time at home and also abroad with the Berlin blockade.
Right.
And obviously he authorized the biggest civilian airdrop in history anywhere in the world with the Berlin airlift operation. So, you know, eventually hundreds of flights a day bringing in medical supplies, food and raw materials to West Berlin. And so he had to take care of this. So, yeah, in no way did he, even though he was so busy, I don't think there's any evidence that he neglected the duties of state. And he was in constant communication with Washington, and indeed the research division, these seven young men that were holed up in DC, they were only ever working 48 hours ahead of the train, and so that these files of the facts that they drew up would be flown out to local municipal airports near the train. A runner would go out and get those, and Truman would read them, you know, just quickly read over the bullet points, and then he'd go back out on the rear platform and make his speech. And so there was constant communication with this research division that really provided the ammo that enabled him to fire his way back into contention.
Philip White is the author of Whistle Stop, How 31,000 Miles of Train Travel, 352 Speeches, and A Little Midwest Gumption Saved the Presidency of Harry Truman. And again, he speaks at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Central Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. And Philip, thanks so much for your time today. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so very much.